Hi everybody. Today we're going to talk a little bit about theology, and some people feel that theology is very unimportant in Judaism. You'll sometimes hear the idea that Judaism is about deed rather than creed, meaning to say God gives you commandments, God gives you actions to do, and God gives you actions to avoid, and one does not necessarily have to examine the theological principles behind those actions other than believing in God, that God gave the mitzvot. That actually happens to be my position as well. But there are many that do talk about the fact that Judaism also has certain dogmas, certain theological constructs, and not very many. And I want to talk a little bit about the history of that and then in terms of what those principles might be. We know that Maimonides, one of the greatest of our rabbis, who was Maimonides really had a triple hitter. Maimonides had three great careers at one time. The least important was he happened to have been a very eminent physician, one of the great physicians of the medieval period, but that's kind of relatively minor in the long-range thing. Number two, he was one of our greatest religious philosophers, in which he attempted to synthesize Aristotelian philosophy and Jewish tradition, and that was his famous book, The Guide to the Perplexed, dealing with people who were very exposed to Aristotle, who was the philosopher that was the most widely studied in the Middle Ages. Of course, Aristotle is from the ancient world, but through Arabic commentators, his words were preserved in the Middle Ages in Islamic countries, although Christian countries were going through the Dark Ages. It's very interesting. At that point in time, the height of civilization was Islam. What happened afterwards is another story, and that is, of course, Bernard Lewis's famous book. I don't remember the exact title, but something like What Happened, meaning what happened to the Arab world is a bit of a tragedy. So he was a physician. He was a great, great religious philosopher. And number three, of course, he was also one of the greatest of halakhic scholars, who systematically codified the entirety of Jewish law. And to this day, it is the only code that covers every single facet of Jewish law. For example, even the Shulchan Aruch, which is called the definitive code of Jewish law, does not cover things that don't apply today. For example, the Shulchan Aruch does not cover sacrifices. It does not cover some agricultural laws which did not apply outside of Israel. The Rambam, Maimonides, covers everything. Rambam, of course, is an abbreviation, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. He spent most of his life in Egypt, in Cairo, and he lived under Islamic domination. Now, Maimonides formulates a creed that is considered to be fairly definitive, and these are called the 13 principles of faith. And they are contained in his commentary to the Mishnah, but they appear in a more popular form in the back of every sitter, and after the morning service, you will find 13 principles of faith. We're not going to go over all of them, but basically, you know that there is one God, that God is one, that God is non-corporeal, God does not have a body, that God gave the Torah will never change, that there's prophecy, there is the Messiah, there is resurrection of the dead, and Maimonides took the very strong position that anyone that denied any one of these principles, for example, if you took the position the Torah could change, that God gave the Torah, but the Torah could change in time, you are classified as a heretic, and you are no longer considered to be part of the Jewish people. And Maimonides was so extreme on this that many interpret Maimonides that even if you didn't have the correct belief because of ignorance, not because of rebellion, but simply because you never learned it, it's like the admission ticket to the world to come. Just because you don't have the money, you still don't get the admission ticket, so to speak. And, you know, as the phrase goes, a heretic is a heretic, even if it's not his fault. This was Maimonides' view of the 13 principles of faith. And even today, many people say that to be a Jew in good standing, you have to subscribe to all of those 13 principles. Now, I need to just mention, for the record, a very important dissenting opinion. And this was a dissenting view of another great Jewish philosopher who lived around 200 years later. And this is Rav Yosef Albo. who lived in Italy. And Rav Yosef Albo argued that Maimonides was confusing or conflating what you might call fundamental principles with derivative principles. Rav Yosef Albo argued, although he agreed with everything Maimonides said in terms of what a Jew should believe, but he disagreed with the classification that all 13 principles are fundamental. And Rav Albo actually argued there are only three fundamental beliefs that a Jew must have, and then there'll be subsidiary derivative principles that come from there. But as long as you believe in the fundamental, even if you're either ignorant or you disbelieve a derivative, you might be mistaken, you might be foolish, you might be dumb, but being stupid is not the same as being a heretic. Now, the three fundamental principles that Rav Albo articulates are the existence of a single God that created heaven and earth. I believe in God. Number two, the existence of a reward and punishment mechanism, either in this world or the world to come. Because without reward or punishment, there's no accountability. There is no justice. There is no reason to be good because there'll be no benefit for it. And there's no reason to avoid evil because there'll be no consequence. So it is mukhrach, meaning it is a forced conclusion that if God created man to live a certain way, there must be some type of reward and punishment system in place. And the third fundamental principle is there was divine revelation of what God's will is, because otherwise we would have no way to know what is good and what is evil. Now, how is Rav Albo differing from the Rambam? So let's take a concrete example. Let's say a person does not believe in a personal Mashiach, right, some Redeemer. Now, that's certainly against the general teachings of Judaism that believes in a Mashiach. According to the Rambam, such a person would be a heretic. Such a person would be excluded from the Jewish people. According to Rav Albo, we would describe it a different way. As long as I do believe, there is a reward and punishment mechanism. Even if I believe it's in the world to come, it's the world of the soul, and there's not going to be a flesh and blood Mashiach, I am not a heretic. I am simply making a mistake. Meaning to say, the particulars of the reward and punishment, whether it's the Messiah, whether it's the world to come, whether it's resurrection of the dead, Rav Albo argued, are derivative principles. They are not fundamental principles. And because they are derivative principles, a person might be mistaken as to the derivative principles and would still be a Jew in good standing. Again, the reason I'm making this clear is because some have made the argument that Rav Albo is essentially denying the idea of Mashiach. Absolutely not. He is not denying the idea of Mashiach. He is simply stating it is not a fundamental, it is a derivative. So in some ways, everybody agrees as to what Jews should believe. They're simply arguing what are the consequences of not believing it. And Maimonides has these 13 principles of faith, and Rav Yosef Albo has three fundamental principles of faith. The idea of God as creator, the idea of God who creates accountability for goodness and evil, and the God that communicated his will through divine revelation. Okay, so there was a whole argument in Jewish philosophy that continues to this very day as to how many dogmas Judaism has and whether Judaism is based on these dogmas at all, or it's simply based on the notion that there is a God and God gave us a Torah. Now, let me mention a third work. So I've mentioned so far The Guide to the Perplexed that was written in the 11th century, and Rav Yosef Albo that was written in the end of the 13th century. Let me mention a book and a philosopher that is even earlier than Maimonides. And we might call him the anti-philosopher philosopher. And this is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who also lived in Spain before Maimonides was born in Spain, but lived in Egypt. Yehuda Halevi actually lived in Spain, and this was during what was called the Golden Age of Spain, when Jews were very, very prominent in the arts and in the sciences and in politics. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi had a multifaceted career. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was, of course, a rabbi. He was a physician. But his love was actually poetry. And he wrote thousands and thousands of poems. many of which are religious poetry, but he also wrote about wine and song and love. He wrote secular poetry as well, which we tend not to look at in the yeshiva world, but indeed he was a man of the world in every sense. And he lived in a society that is not too different than the United States. It was a society at a time where Jews were given political and social and economic rights. Remember, the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492, but this is way before that. It was a time in which many Jews were assimilated to the prevailing culture. And even Jews who may have been halakhically observant were not infused with the passion of Judaism, because their passion was predominantly in that culture. And Rabbi Halevi himself in his youth was kind of that way. He was always halakhically observant, but his passions were in that general culture. And towards the end of his life, he actually went through what you might call a religious epiphany, to borrow a Christian phrase, that he saw a certain shallowness and emptiness in the secular decadent life of the pleasures of the flesh. And he resolved that he wanted to die in the land of Israel. Now, I want to point out, going to the land of Israel in the 11th century is not like coming to the land of Israel in the 21st century. I can assure you they didn't have Ben and Jerry's ice cream or Skippy peanut butter or cell phones. Life was extremely hard. He was leaving an affluent, comfortable existence where he was wealthy, well-regarded, and going to a place that was desolate, empty, abandoned, dangerous. Dangerous in all ways. The trip was dangerous. Living in Jerusalem itself, let's say, you could be attacked by wild animals, by marauders, by Arabs, well, some things don't change indeed, and the like. And yet, his desire to be close to God was so strong that he was willing to sacrifice all the material comforts of the diaspora to spend his last days in the house of God. And he undertook that great voyage with great, great, great personal sacrifice. Now, whether he got to Israel, historically we're not really sure. There are two different accounts of how Rav Yehuda Halevi ended his life. Account number one is he never made it. Account number one is he got as far as Alexandria in Egypt, and he died in Alexandria before he ever got to Eretz Israel. But there is an account number two that some say is a legend, so I can't vouch for its accuracy, that he actually came to the gates of Jerusalem and he prostrated himself on the ground, kissing the dirt, kissing the stones. And as he was crying and sobbing in both joy and in sadness that we don't have a temple and the like, the legend has it an Arab horseman drove by and pierced him with a spear. And he died by the very gates of Jerusalem without ever entering the city. Who knows? This is a well-beloved and often repeated story. We're not entirely sure if it is true or not. But these types of stories, even if they're not factually true, are emotionally true, because it certainly expresses the feelings that Rav Yehuda Halevi had towards Eretz Yisrael, towards Jerusalem. Now, why am I bringing this in? Because shortly before he left, in the last years of his life in Spain, he wrote a book, a very, very famous book of Jewish philosophy that is even earlier than Maimonides. And this book is called The Kuzari. And maybe you've heard of it, maybe you've read it a little bit, maybe you've read about it. But it's a very, very fascinating book because it is a philosophical treatise that is really kind of a historical novel. Meaning to say, he used a historical event that had occurred several hundred years earlier and he kind of fictionalized it and made it the basis of his philosophical study. And this was the story of the Khazar nation. The Khazars were a group of warlike tribes that lived in Russia. This goes back to the 900s. This goes back a long way. And the Khazars, somehow, the whole nation, converted to Judaism. Now, that's pretty fascinating, because so many people who are Jewish want to get out of it, and it's highly unusual that in a culture which was so overwhelmingly either Christian or Muslim, that a whole nation would convert to Judaism. And these were not people who were like very unusual people as well, because these were not the people who sat in the Beis Medrash and learned Torah. This was a warrior nation. These were tough guys, and they just converted to Judaism. So you could imagine. Now, the Khazars, by the way, are now considered to be extinct. They eventually intermingled with other tribes, and we don't know who they are, where they are. They're kind of gone. Although there is a theory. There is a theory. Now, it's a discarded academic theory, but there was an academic theory that was very popular, that most Ashkenazic Jews are descended from the Khazars, because that explains some of the ethnic and racial problems we have in Jewish identity. Because after all, if the Jewish people from Abraham are a Mid-Eastern people, the people that come from Babylonia, etc., then we should have darker complexions and the like. You know, why do Jews have, not why do Ashkenazic Jews have light complexions and the like? And some have surmised that Ashkenazim are descended not from the indigenous Jewish nation, but they're descended from the Khazars. Okay, but that's, as I say, there's a lot of debate and discussion about that, and I don't necessarily want to focus too much on it. But be it as it may, the story of this Khazar nation converting to Judaism exerted a great, great interest in people's imagination. Who were these people? Why did they do it? And the story that was preserved was because the king had a dream. The king of the Khazars, his name was King Bulan, the king of the Khazars had a dream in which an angel of God appeared to him and said, "Your intentions and your desires are worthy and noble, but your actions are not correct. Find the path of truth." And legend had it, this was already a legend in Rabbi Halevi's time, that the king was a seeker of truth, so he summoned, sounds like an old joke, he summoned a priest and a Muslim, an imam, and an atheistic philosopher to kind of teach him what is the pathway of life. And he didn't like what he heard. And he didn't even bother asking a rabbi, because he said the Jews certainly don't have it. But then he figured, if all of those other ways didn't work, he'll try the Jew, hear what the Jew says. And this was the story that the Jew convinced him, and he converted to Judaism. Now this was a very fragmentary story, just a legend, a story that was preserved. Historically it was true that the Khazars underwent a mass conversion, but the idea of the angel, you know, we don't know if that happens or not. But Rav Yehuda Halevi took that story and he constructed a dialogue between the rabbi and the king of the Khazars, in which the king of the Khazars raised all of his questions about Judaism and the rabbi answered it. And Rav Yehuda Halevi used that dramatic structure. Only a poet would write a philosophical book like that. Maimonides, you could not imagine Maimonides writing a book of that nature. Maimonides was a philosopher, so he expounded philosophy. Rav Yehuda Halevi was a poet's philosopher, so he uses a literary structure to convey the truths of Judaism. But you have to understand that everything is made up. In other words, the whole dialogue is made up. In fact, even when the king asks questions, it's not really the king that's asking the questions. It's Rav Yehuda Halevi putting the questions in the king's mouth, and then the rabbi is Rav Yehuda Halevi giving the answer, etc. And he uses this story as the background. So what makes the Khuzri interesting is, number one, that the questions are questions that a Jewish person might ask, because essentially the king is Rav Yehuda Halevi and the rabbi is Rav Yehuda Halevi, and he's addressing both points. Okay, so the Khuzri is a work of Jewish philosophy, but in many, many ways it is a profoundly anti-philosophical work, because Rav Yehuda Halevi was deeply convinced that the deepest truths of life are based on experience rather than rational syllogistic thoughts. Meaning, the way one knows that there's a God, the way one knows the truths of the Torah, is not by philosophically proving them, but it's based on the experience of the Exodus and the experience of Revelation. He makes an interesting point, which again is a poet's point, that is very interesting. He talks about, he compares philosophers and poets, and he says the following. He says that there are people who know the laws of grammar and know the laws of meter and know the rules for syllable length, but they don't know how to write a poem. They just know all the rules, but they can't do anything with it. And then there are people, he said, who intuitively know how to use language, even though they don't necessarily know the rules of grammar. I mean, think about how a child learns language. I mean, this is why it's so difficult for an adult to learn a language. Because when you sit down, you want to learn Hebrew, you want to learn French, you want to learn Russian, whatever language you want to learn. So you start memorizing grammar, subjects and verbs and predicate nominatives and adjectives and modifications and gerunds. That's not a natural way of speaking. In other words, when I have to say something, I have to think, do I want to use the adjective before or after? When you kind of have to speak a language based on a self-conscious awareness of rules, you're not going to do very well. But you pick up, a child picks up language intuitively by hearing words, by just being exposed into an environment. Rav Yehuda Halevi said, religious truths are not always susceptible to philosophical proof, but they are based on deep intuition, and they are based on historical experience. So although it is a book of philosophy in many, many ways, you can actually sense he has an antipathy towards philosophers who believe that reason is the source of all virtue, when in fact, sometimes there is direct, unmediated experience of God that is not always susceptible to rational demonstration. So now, I know this is a little abstract, but now let me just give you concretely what the Kuzari does. When the Kuzari, well, the Kuzari is the name of the book, but when the king of the Khazars asks the rabbi, how do you know that Judaism is true? How do you know that the God of Israel is the God that we should worship? Maybe not. Maybe he doesn't exist. Maybe all of these things are made up. So the Kuzari said that the veracity of Judaism is based on historical experience that cannot be falsified. Now, he is not the first one who made this argument. There was actually an earlier philosopher, Rav Sadia Gaon, who was actually the first Jewish philosopher. But Rav Yehuda Halevi kind of plagiarized this idea and developed this idea much more. And that is the following. All religious traditions, all religions, are based on on revelation, that God appears. But Judaism is unique because it is the only religion that is based on mass revelation. So, let's take an example. If I want to convince you to follow me, right? I want to convince you that I am a man of God, I am a prophet, and I come to you and I say, God spoke to me. God gave me commandments. God gave me directions. If you trust me, if you believe in me, if I've given you reason, I'm not saying that you have that reason, but let's assume that, you know, I've done good things for you, I've been a good leader. So it's possible for me to convince you that God appeared to me. Now, maybe I'm lying. Maybe I had hallucinations. Maybe I'm imagining things. But if you trust me enough and I'm persuasive enough and I'm charismatic enough, I might be able to convince you that God appeared to me and you should be my followers. And eventually, as I start off with 10 followers, the 10 will talk to other people and eventually that might spread. So theoretically, it's entirely possible to have a religion that is based on a claim of a revelation to only a small number of people that may eventually have millions of adherents. Because as long as the founder was believable, trustworthy, charismatic, he might be lying, he might be hallucinating, but once he's believed, that's going to be fine. But Rav Yehuda Levi says, a claim that God appeared to me is not the same as a claim that God appeared to you. Meaning, two claims. If I say God appeared to me, I might be able to convince you. But if I say God appeared to you, that's a much more difficult claim to convince somebody of, because you're going to scratch your head and say, you know, I just don't remember that happening. And certainly a claim that God appeared to millions and millions of people, how does such a lie start? Who is going to believe such a